Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
Whistling Pines, Chapter 16. With the fragrance of turkey pot pies getting stronger, Jeremy and I sat at the kitchen table and worked our way through his pre-algebra assignment. I'd done well in school, but math wasn't my favorite subject. Having taken algebra a decade before, I found myself searching the recesses of my memory to recall the equations that Jeremy needed to solve the problems. After solving a number of problems based on simple equations, Jeremy got to the word problems at the end of the assigned questions. Jeremy and I read the inevitable question about two trains traveling toward each other at different speeds. "Why do they make us do word problems?" Jeremy asked, pushing the book away. "I know how to do all the problems just fine, and then they put this stupid word question in, and I'm lost." "Well, Jeremy," I said, pulling the book back, "in the real world, no one will ask you to solve for X and give you the equation. There will be some problem that they throw out, like, how long will it take to get a spaceship to Mars, orbit three times, and return to Earth? You'll have to put the numbers in to make the equation, and then you'll have to get the answer." Jeremy squinted at me. "Hello, I don't intend to be a rocket scientist. I just want to pass algebra." "It doesn't matter what profession you choose, you'll always have word problems that have to be solved." Our conversation was interrupted by a sound like a firecracker going off just outside my house. There was a second, then a third, immediately followed by the whine of a ricochet. I pulled Jeremy off his chair onto the floor beside me. To the best of my knowledge, there had never been a drive-by shooting in Two Harbors, unless you counted poaching deer with a spotlight. I wasn't terribly worried that we were targets, but ricochets were not particular about who they struck. "Stay here," I admonished Jeremy, who was shocked at being thrown to the floor. He nodded agreement. I edged to the window and peeked out just as two more shots rang out. My neighbor, Dolores Carvenan, was standing on her back porch, pointing a rifle into her backyard. After ordering Jeremy again to stay on the floor until I returned, I slipped out the front door and ran to Dolores's house. I slid along the side until I reached the corner where I could see her. Following the angle of the quivering gun barrel, I could see a cottontail rabbit munching on the swelling dogwood buds. Two more shots rang out, hitting landscape rock several feet behind the rabbit, not disturbing him a bit. "Dolores," I called out, "hold your fire." She turned to look at me and luckily kept the gun pointed toward the garden. "Peter, come here and shoot that pesky rodent. He's going to kill the dogwoods before they even bud out." "Point the gun toward the sky and take your finger off the trigger." Once she complied, I climbed over the railing and walked to her side, taking the guns from her hand. In the distance, I could hear the wail of a siren. "You can't shoot rabbits in town," I explained as I removed the shells from the old Remington 22 rifle. "There are houses behind your bushes." "I know that," she snapped. "I wasn't shooting at the houses, I was shooting at that darned rabbit." The rabbit had moved to a second bush and was nibbling off all the buds within his reach. "If my knees were better, I'd be out there chasing him off, but I can't get around any more, so I found Joe's old varmint gun and decided to deal with it." The siren stopped a couple blocks away. Within a few seconds, I could hear a car door slam in front of the house. "I think the police are here to talk to you," I said, carefully setting the rifle aside so I didn't appear threatening to the officer. The sound of jingling keys preceded the arrival of Kurt Olson, who stopped at the same corner I'd used for cover. His chubby face came into view one eye at a time. "It's okay, Kurt. I've secured the gun." Dolores strained to see Kurt in the fading sunlight. "Is that a cop?" she asked, as Kurt pulled his sizable girth over the railing, falling after catching a toe on the way. I called you an hour ago about that rabbit, and it's taken you this long to get here," Dolores said sternly. She pointed to the offending rabbit and said, "There he is. Just shoot him and you can leave." Kurt looked at the rabbit, looked at me, and then looked at Dolores. "I'm here because of the gunshots, not the rabbit," Kurt explained. "Well, as long as you're here, you might as well shoot the rabbit," Dolores said, with her hands on her hips. Kurt dusted himself off and said, "Mrs. Carvenan, we had a call that someone is shooting over here. One of the shots nicked the postman's cat on the ear. I guess that cat was spinning like a whirling dervish and then dove under their porch. Now he won't come out, and I'm here to make sure there isn't any more shooting." I nodded toward the rusty old gun. "It's no longer loaded." "Well, someone else must have shot that worthless cat," Dolores said in a huff. "I was only shooting at the rabbit. The cat probably deserved it. They're always into something. If the cat had been worth anything at all, it would have chased that rabbit out of here long ago." Dolores glared at Kurt for a second, then asked, "Are you going to shoot the rabbit now?" "I can't discharge my firearm inside the city limits unless someone's life is in danger," Kurt said, picking up the rifle to make sure it wasn't loaded. "He's killing my dogwoods," Dolores yelled. "Are you blind?" Kurt's eyes were almost pleading when he looked at me for support. I walked down the steps and across the yard, noting all the little tufts of grass that had been turned up by the errant bullets. When I was about 10 feet away, the rabbit bolted. "There, see how Peter did that? At least someone is willing to take decisive action." Dolores reached for her rifle, but Kurt pulled it away. "I'm sorry, ma'am, but I have to confiscate your gun. You can't shoot inside the city limits, and the county attorney will probably ask us to give you a ticket for a reckless discharge of a firearm." I shook my head. "There weren't any witnesses, Kurt. There wasn't any shooting going on when you got here, and I'm sure I didn't see anything in this fading light either." "Do you have any children who might be willing to take care of your rifle, Mrs. Carvenan?" Kurt asked. "Joe and I were never blessed with children. I'll take the gun back." "You know," I said to Dolores, "if you let me keep the gun for you, I could try to keep the rabbits out of your dogwoods." It seems that the sights weren't working too well because I kept missing the stupid rabbit. "Maybe you can get them fixed and then we can shoot that rabbit." With that, she turned and went into the house. "Man," Kurt said, "that was scary. Did you see how thick her glasses are? I'm amazed that she could see that there were sights on the gun." "I don't think she can," I responded. "I'm surprised she could see the rabbit. How's your investigation of Axel Olsen's death going?" I asked Kurt. "I don't get into it much. Len seems to be frustrated at the lack of leads, but I think he's kind of hoping that you come up with something from the residents and staff." "There are a lot of people at the residence who didn't have much time for Axel, and that's not many who are going to shed a tear at the funeral, but I don't think that I've found anyone who hated him enough to kill him." "I think the Axel Olsen fan club was pretty small," Kurt agreed as we stopped on the cracked sidewalk in front of my house. "I remember him sitting in the cafe with a cribbage board and a deck of cards. He'd play for quarters, and I don't think I ever saw him leave with fewer quarters than he started with. I saw a trucker throw the whole deck of cards at Axel after getting double skunked. Axel just smiled and asked for his winnings. Everyone was pretty sure he was cheating, but no one could ever figure out how." Whistling Pines, Chapter 17. I found Jeremy sitting in front of the television with the oven timer buzzing in the kitchen. "How long ago did the buzzer go off?" I called to Jeremy as I searched drawers trying to find a hot pad. "What buzzer?" he yelled back from the living room. I shut the buzzer off and pulled the oven door open. "That buzzing sound coming out of my timer saying that the pot pies are done." "I didn't hear it until you turned it off," he replied. The pot pies were a little over-browned, but not burned. That was a major accomplishment in my culinary attempts. I heard Jenny open the front door as I pulled the last pot pie from the oven. "Peter, why is there a gun leaning against the coat rack, and can you make it go away?" Don't worry, it's not loaded, I replied. I'll take it to the basement as soon as I turn off the oven. Cool, what kind of a gun is it? Jeremy asked as I whisked it away a second before he tried to pick it up. Is that the one from the drive-by shooting? What drive-by shooting? Jenny asked. The concern in her voice stopped me in my tracks. There was no drive-by shooting, I said calmly. Then why did we have to duck and cover? Jeremy asked, being a typical non-helpful tween. Dolores, my next-door neighbor, was shooting at a rabbit in her backyard. That's all it was, I said as I started down the basement stairs. And I thought I told you to stay on the floor until I got back, I said to Jeremy. You were gone a long time, Jeremy replied, and there wasn't any more shooting. She shot a rabbit in her backyard, right next to your house? Jenny yelled down the basement stairwell. I slid the gun into the rafters and started back up the stairs. No, she shot at a rabbit. She didn't hit it. Why is she shooting the rabbits in town? Jenny's patience was wearing thin, and my efforts to minimize the situation weren't very effective. She shot at him because he was eating her dogwood bushes, I replied as I pulled plates from the cupboard and set three places at the table. It really wasn't a big deal. She was shooting into the ground. Yeah, Jeremy jumped in. Except for the cool ricochet, zing! It sounded just like they do on the cop shows. I tried to give Jeremy a shut-up look, but I just didn't have the power in my glare. Or maybe my look was being canceled out by the look I was getting from Jenny. So is that the only gun Dolores has? Jenny asked as she set out silverware. I'm sure it is, I replied, realizing too late that there was no conviction in my voice. Jenny was on the way to the door before I could pour glasses of milk. Come on, Peter, we're going to see if she has any other guns. But supper, I said to her back as she stepped out the door. For a small person with short legs, Jenny moved fast when her adrenaline was flowing. Maybe it was the adrenaline, or maybe it was the lioness instinct to protect her cub. Either way, she was knocking on Dolores's door before I hit the bottom step. When the door opened, we were side by side. Peter and Jenny, how nice of you to stop over, Dolores said, beaming at the prospect of company. Actually, her name is Jenny, I said to Dolores's back, as she took Jenny by the elbow and led her into the sitting room. Dolores put Jenny in one of two matching upholstered chairs with carved arms and brocade covers. I was left standing at the edge of a beautiful ivory and burgundy wool rug that was probably hand-tied when Iran was still called Persia. I wandered over to an old roll-top desk that appeared to be solid teak. The matching chair creaked as I sat down, then nearly flipped me over backwards when I leaned back. Oh, Peter, stop being such a clown, Dolores admonished me. Joe used to do that same trick for laughs when we entertained during the war. Could I offer you a glass of sherry? Oh, thank you so much, but we really can't stay very long, Jenny said, making a complete transition from protective lioness to charming guest. We came over because we're concerned about your guns. My guns? Dolores said, completely surprised. Well, yes, Peter's taking care of the one you used to shoot the rabbit, Jenny cooed, but it's so rusty I was wondering if you would like Peter to take care of any others that you have so they don't rust and get ruined. To say that I was in awe would be an understatement. Seeing Jenny turn her ire into manipulative compassion and concern was eye-opening. I'd seen her use smaller doses of this technique at Whistling Pines, but this performance was something to behold. Why, yes, Dolores responded. She turned her head as if in thought, then said, Let's see what shape the others are in. I haven't been in that cabinet in years. She led us up the stairs and into a bedroom with a canopy bed that looked like something out of a museum. The matching furniture was exquisitely carved walnut with a dark varnish finish. The bedspread and canopy appeared to be matching red silk embroidered with gold thread. Near the window was a small cabinet with a marble wash basin and a ewer that appeared to have been cut from the same marble. Dolores opened a closet, exposing an armoire that matched the other furniture with beautiful moose and elk carvings cut into the front panels. She removed a small key from a hook on the side of the cabinet and unlocked the doors. When she opened them, she revealed an amazing collection of pistols hanging from the doors and long guns standing inside the cabinet. "I don't know a lot about guns," she said, stepping back from the cabinet. She pointed to one. "My father gave Joe this gun for a wedding present. He called it a Purdy or something like that, and Joe was quite impressed. He always said that he couldn't bear to shoot the thing for fear of ruining it." I looked into the cabinet and saw the gun she was pointing to. It was an old double-barreled shotgun with external hammers and gold inlays depicting the pheasants on the wing. The other long guns appeared to be of the same vintage, and the pistols were nearly all made for black powder and looked very old. Dolores saw me staring at a pistol and redirected my gaze. "I don't know much about most of these, but I think this one was my grandfather's from the Civil War. He commanded Company C of the 3rd Minnesota Volunteer Regiment, who laid siege to Vicksburg. His sword is over here in the corner." "Dolores," I said, searching for words, "these belong in a museum." I picked up a badly battered pistol that didn't seem to fit with the rest of the carefully oiled, pristine firearms. "That odd one that you're looking at," she said, pointing to the worn piece with all the bluing worn off, "that was given to my father by General Pershing after World War I. He told Daddy that he'd bought it from a Mexican bartender who claimed that it had been taken from the dead hand of Jim Bowie after the Mexicans overran the Alamo. I never put much stock in that, but it was so special to my father that I felt we should keep it." I gently replaced the scarred pistol, closed and locked the cabinet, and slipped the key on a ring with my house key. "I'll hold this key for safekeeping." Jenny gently led Dolores from the room, using the same gentle elbow nudge that her mother had used on me earlier in the day. "We should contact your relatives so they're aware of this historical collection," she suggested. "Oh, that's not necessary," Dolores explained as we went down the stairs. "My mother died in childbirth, and my father could never bear the thought of losing another wife, so he never married again. Joe had two brothers who were killed in the Pacific during the war, and Joe and I were never blessed with children, so you see, there really is no family to pass this on to." "Well, we certainly need to contact your insurance agent to make sure you have adequate coverage for all your valuables," Jenny suggested. Dolores made a frown. "Joe didn't believe in insurance. He said, 'Put the premiums in your pocket, and in 10 years you'll be money ahead.' We've lived by that credo. All those premiums that we've never paid amount to a tidy sum of money." "I guess it's a generational thing," I said with a shrug. "Just like Axel Olsen, he never put a penny in a bank because he didn't trust them and didn't want them making money off his money." Dolores's eyes narrowed. "Axel Olsen was a bounder of the highest order." "A bounder?" I asked. "He tried long ago to swindle Joe on a land deal. Joe got wise to him and turned the tables on him. It could have been tough for us, except that everyone else in the area knew about Axel and his shady business. Axel hired an attorney out of Minneapolis because no one up here would touch anything that had to do with him. The judge in town almost laughed him out of the courtroom. You should have seen that Minneapolis attorney. His face was the color of a cooked beet after the tongue-lashing he got from the judge." "Did anyone else ever get the best of Axel?" Jenny asked. "There was one guy that came to us after we got through with the court case. I don't remember his name, but he was the money man in a project where Axel was supplying the brains and taking most of the profit. He came and met with Joe, and I think that he left with some ideas about how to handle Axel. It's a pity that the poor man was killed in a duck hunting accident the next week. His boat tipped over and he drowned or froze to death, as I remember it. Whistling Pines, Chapter 18, Wednesday. On Wednesday morning, the names on the new, expanded sign-up sheets for transportation to Axel's funeral overran the available space. Little old people with shaking hands, trained in the spiky Palmer method of handwritten script, made for difficult reading at best. Some wrote their names in the margins of the paper, and deciphering the names became as difficult as solving the cryptoquip in the Duluth News Tribune. After 15 minutes, I gave up and assumed that every resident who didn't own a car was going to need a ride. Carolyn Young, the transportation coordinator for the Two Harbors Unified School District, said she needed the school buses on school day afternoons. They could not let me rent even one bus for the funeral. She was very cordial, but I could tell that I was getting the "Are you stupid?" treatment by the tone of her voice. I tried calling a tour bus service in Duluth, but both of their buses were already booked with tours to Branson, Missouri. I was Googling bus and Duluth when I heard the whisper of cloth rubbing against cloth a moment before a shadow blocked the light coming through my office door. "Are you still searching for bagpipes?" Wendy asked, trying to peek over my shoulder at the computer screen. I clicked off the monitor and turned to face her. There really wasn't anything to hide, but I knew that a hidden screen would drive her crazy with curiosity. "Do you have someone?" "No, but we're only days away from the funeral, and the person responsible for the music," she said, pointing at me, "has a big hole in the program where there is supposed to be music. All the little old ladies believe that there will be bagpipes playing, and right now it looks like it will be filled with you singing a cappella. First of all, we are jointly responsible for the music, and you will be either performing or accompanying the performer of our choice. I am trying to find bagpipes." I turned the screen on, illuminating the bus search screen. "Secondly, if I don't find a bus to haul our residents, it looks like I'll be making laps with the van for a couple hours." "My cousin has a bus," Wendy said, looking at the screen. "It looks a lot like that, only without windows." She pointed at a large tour bus that said it seated 58 people. "Why does your cousin have a tour bus?" "Because of tours," she replied sarcastically, adding "duh" to the implied insult. "What kind of tours?" I asked, trying to remain polite. "He's the driver for the Seasick Sailors." I must have given her my best look of confusion because she added, "They're a polka band. They tour around the Midwest about 4 months a year." "So the Seasick Sailors are not on tour right now, and your cousin might be able to drive a couple of loads of senior citizens to a funeral?" "I can ask. The worst that'll happen is that he'll say they're on tour, or that he doesn't want to." I pushed the phone across the desk to her. "I'm kind of running out of time. Can you call him now?" Wendy glanced at her watch. "He's not a morning person, and I really don't like to interrupt him when he's, entertaining an overnight guest." She looked at the phone nervously. "Please." She picked up the phone and dialed the number from memory while I turned to the computer and Googled the Seasick Sailors. Within seconds, I had a picture of 7 guys all wearing blue blazers and captain's caps standing around their instruments. The youngest appeared to be 60. The accordion player looked like he was past 80. "Enos, this is Wendy. How are you?" Wendy asked as she put the conversation on speakerphone. "Wendy," the voice sounded very tentative, "I'm doing well. Sorry I didn't call, but you know how things get busy with the band and all." "This is your cousin, Wendy." "Oh, that Wendy," Enos's voice, which sounded a little raspy, like a longtime smoker, almost dripped with relief. "Long time no see. What can I do for you?" "I'm guessing that you're still the front man for the band and spending a little time with some of the polka groupies." "Now, Wendy, groupie is a rather derogatory term. I like to think of them as grateful fans. So you're calling to check on my love life?" I'm working at the Whistling Pines in Two Harbors, and we've got a problem. We need to drive a bunch of senior citizens from Whistling Pines to a church funeral, and I can't find anyone who has a bus available for the funeral. I was wondering if you could drive the band bus over and ferry a couple of loads of senior citizens for us. When Enos's answer didn't jump from the phone, I whispered, "Tell him we could pay $100. "Do I need to drive to the cemetery?" "No, we just need to get 2 busloads from Whistling Pines to the Lutheran church." "Lutherans, hmm? Are they catering lunch?" Wendy put up a finger and leaned close to the speakerphone. "The Lutheran ladies are catering lunch themselves. I heard that they're doing ham sandwiches, salads, and cakes. I'm sure they'll have a couple Jell-O salads, too." "You know, Jell-O salads aren't a big draw for me anymore. The last Baptist funeral I went to had a lime Jell-O salad with canned peas floating in it. Can't say that's a recipe that I'd save. Now, if you tell me that there's going to be a tangerine Jell-O salad with mandarin oranges, well, I might be interested in that. Even better would be a rice pudding or tapioca pudding, as long as they don't dump a bunch of raisins into it. Enos, I'll make a raisinless rice pudding myself if you'll drive the bus. You know, the band isn't booked. I could call the guys and we could play for the dance," Enos offered. "Enos, this is a funeral, not a wedding," Wendy said. "There are bands at funerals. Haven't you ever seen an Irish wake?" Enos asked. "Enos, these are Swedish Lutherans. We can barely get them to sway with the funeral music, much less dance. Besides, they don't play polkas at Irish wakes. Say, is this the Friday funeral with the bagpipes?" he asked. "I've never seen a bagpiper. I'd be willing to drive for nothing if you've got live bagpipes." "It's a deal," Wendy said, as I flapped my arms trying to stop her from making the promise. "I'll see you at 11 Friday."
You've been listening to Episode 8 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the home page. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.